So, Evangelion, if that's pronounced correctly, what we call the Gospel, is a Greek word signifying good, merry, glad, joyful news that makes a man's heart glad and makes him sing, dance, and leap for joy. William Tyndale, the pioneer translator of the Bible into English, wrote those delightful words in 1525, and he sealed them with a martyr's death. What a world we live in, that something so happy should be so hated. Well, that's actually a quote from the introduction to a book by Ray Auckland titled The Gospel, How the Church Portrays the Beauty of Christ. Well, we started last week looking at how God's glory is shared, and we're going to be continuing on that theme for a few more weeks. God's glory, I don't really know how to describe that. It's a kind of a concept that is familiar, but what is it? Well, last week, Ben spoke to us, and he was talking about how God's glory is seen in his image in us. So that's a kind of a starting point, and we're going to take a little bit of a sort of a broad sweep over the next few weeks through the Gospel as we try to grapple with this idea of God's glory, and furthermore, God's glory being shared with us. And today I'm going to explore how we shape up compared to God's glory. And so why then the Gospel is the joyous news that William Tyndale not only described, but gave his life for. I don't know about you, but sometimes I find that there's a kind of a sticking point in the Gospel message. I found that when I've sort of tried to talk to others about it, one of the points at which people stick is when it comes to acknowledging our sinful nature or realizing that we cannot please God and that we are in need of forgiveness. But I'm a good person, people say. I mean, I never murdered anybody. I give to charity. I try to behave morally. I even go to church at Christmas, or even every week. But Paul writes to those in Rome, "For everyone has sinned. We fall short of God's glorious standard," or the sort of the phrase that you might know very well from older familiar translations, "We fall short of the glory of God." Now, I know that I've not only mentioned this a number of times before, I've probably banged on about it, quite frankly. But a few years ago, I undertook the Bishop of Huntington's Bible Challenge, which was to read the Bible from cover to cover in the 40 days of Lent. And if there's one abiding memory from that, apart from the incredibly sore eyes, it was an impression that I had was the overwhelming sense of the holiness of God. I've never seen it in the same way before than when you just read right the way through the holiness of God. And so actually I have no difficulty in realizing how short I fall. And I think that anyone on reading, truly reading the Bible, would find the same as well. And so to discover that there is a remedy for this, well, that's the wonderful news. That's the wonderful news. And I think it's really worth, if you can spend some time this week reading around those few chapters in Romans. We've just heard a small part this morning. Because in chapter 4, Paul writes, "But people are counted as righteous not because of their work, but because of their faith in God, who forgives sinners. And David also spoke of this when he described the happiness of those who are declared righteous without working for it. Oh, what joy for those whose disobedience is forgiven, whose sins are put out of sight. Yes, what joy for those whose record the Lord has cleared of sin. He's quoting from a psalm there, a psalm of David. So there, way back in the Old Testament, there's always a reference to God's desire to rescue people from the consequences of their sin. And in Paul's letter, he says that this was to show the way in which God's glory would be shown by the action of Jesus, taking our guilt and that of generations past and present and future for everyone. And remember, we have all fallen short of God's perfection. There is a way back to the Father, in whose image we heard last week we were originally created. And so for Israel, the people of his holy nation, they were given the commandments, the law, by which they could live in ways pleasing to God, and instructions for the sacrifices that would be made to him. But this doesn't really work with people whose very nature has fallen through the entering of sin and disobedience into the world. We know that. And so this, I have to say, sometimes makes me wonder. Did God know this would be impossible? Did he plan it this way? I don't know. Had he always intended sending his son to earth? Was that a change of plan? I don't know. I'm not God. But I do know this. Jesus gave a new commandment, a commandment that takes nothing away from those of the old, but which asks us not to kind of tie ourselves in knots with wrestle or wriggle our way out of the letter of the law, but to live freely in the spirit of the law of love. Now, I said I thought it would be really useful to read around the passage from Romans that we heard this morning, because I think the Apostle Paul had to kind of really lay things on thick for those who had come to faith in Rome. Because if you think about it, the Roman gods, whilst they were personal gods, you know, some cultures saw gods as just spirits, these were personified, but they were nevertheless understood as kind of both raging over the head of humanity at the same time as really kind of interfering with life here on earth. And they were to be feared as kind of malevolently judgmental characters. And you would be very wary of invoking their wrath in all of your daily activity. And yet here is a God who forgives sin and releases you from its bondage. So that Roman mindset, you know, had to be overcome quite powerfully. And then we, by contrast, find ourselves in a culture that finds the very notion of any God as, well, illogical, irrelevant, or the product of even a deluded or feeble mind. And the notion of a God who cannot abide our sin, well, but I'm a good person, remember? The book that I referred to by Ray Auckland on the Gospel it's part of a series, and the editors for that series said in their introduction that local churches exist to display God's glory to the nations. We do that by fixing our eyes on the Gospel of Jesus Christ, trusting him for salvation, and then loving one another with God's own holiness, unity, and love. And I hope that we emulate this with the St. James motto, which you've seen on these cards that we have, with a quote from Hebrews, which says, "Let us think of ways to motivate one another to acts of love and good works." So rather than me try to explain this concept any further, let me tell you what it feels like. Okay, what God's glory feels like. Well, last Sunday was quite an epic day for me. I was singing in the band at 11 o'clock service, and I hadn't been able to make the rehearsal during the week. And yet, I was aware of receiving such generous and gentle grace from the worship leader and the other members of the band as I sort of tried to keep up to speed, if you like. And then within that service, the gospel message was preached clearly and graciously and beautifully. Then following the service over coffee, I had some fantastic conversations with people. And as I looked around the church, I just felt so utterly in love with this church family, where I am known, where I know others, warts and all. And all our problems are shared and cared for. I could see other conversations going on around, some of them just frivolous, but nevertheless just so comfy and warm and engaged because we know one another and we have something very special in common. And then the cherry on the top of that morning was an impromptu invitation to lunch with a young couple that we're just getting to know. Not just any lunch. It was roast lamb with all the trimmings and apple crumble to follow. I mean, it was fantastic, wonderful, unexpected and undeserved grace. Just in that, you know, that is the local church displaying the glory of God. And actually, it's also one of the ways in which we make disciples, not just of each other. We sort of sometimes think about making disciples as just getting out there and preaching in the market square. But it's also how we encourage one another. We bring God into the conversation. And when people are flagging in their faith, which we all do, to just keep helping people hang in there and encourage them and have a word for them that will lift them up. And actually it's that drew me into the church as a child. My brother and I used to sneak off together to church, quite separate from our parents who didn't go. This church was attached to the junior school that I went to, where I found a loving, loving family and knew I belonged there. And then later, the same again when I was at college, found people who had that special something. And that drew me to them. And then I encountered Jesus for myself. So, what a perfect day I was having. But I realised on going to bed that I had relaxed actually and let go so much that day that I had forgotten to check my emails. So, I took a look. Oh my goodness, how I wished I hadn't. I was absolutely devastated to discover that there had been a terrible confusion over the dates for something that I was organising. And actually, the speaker that I had booked had actually gone to that event 2 weeks ago, when the event is in several weeks' time, and actually wasn't going to be available on the real date of the event. I was absolutely mortified, and I was trawling through the kind of email exchanges that we'd been having, trying to work out where things had gone wrong, and actually it wasn't entirely clear. And I know that we'd had conversations on the phone and even face to face, and I could not for the life of me remember how, you know, our conversations to know how this had gone wrong. I felt I had committed a most terrible offence, and whether my fault or not, and it probably was, I was certainly going to have to deal with the consequences. And I was actually so distraught. Poor Mike, he was just dozing off to sleep, and I woke him up saying, I've done this terrible thing. And actually, if I'm honest, I actually cried myself to a very fitful sleep that night. But, you know, through those tears, I could pray for forgiveness. You know, it wasn't a deliberate sin, but we would all say that. We don't commit deliberate sins, do we? But I had fallen very, very short. And in the morning, whatever, I felt that I would have to put this right. So I emailed all of those who were affected by this and involved, including the bishop, and I telephoned the speaker with my profuse apologies. And I was expecting, you know, a surly response, quite frankly. But instead, I received a very, very gracious one. I resolved to pay their fee because this was an error or a mission that was not without consequences for them. And I called my superior in this matter, who was gentle and forgiving. And I said, should I let everybody know in advance about this, you know, terrible mistake? And he said, no, I don't want you beating yourself up about this. He wanted to kind of cover my shame, if you like. And so we resolved that he would sort out one aspect of it, and that I'm going to try to attempt to do what that speaker was originally intended to do. And would you believe I phoned the speaker again, I contacted the speaker again, and he talked me all the way through what he was planning to do. And then he sent all of his notes to me and said, you know, if there's anything else I can do to help. That's kind of what forgiveness feels like. That's the glory of God shown in the local church. That is the gospel in the flesh. That's a glimpse of the good news that rushes to greet us in the person of Jesus. Not waiting till we've made the sacrifice and done the penance, but like that, the father of the prodigal son, the minute you just turn around and go, oh, he rushes out and flings his arms around you. We need to remember that in the book of Revelation, which describes the day of judgment, God speaks to his churches as well as to individuals. We don't want to be found as one of those churches on the last day that he says is lukewarm. Instead, we should be found having loved God first and our neighbours as ourselves. So through the gospel message shown in attitude and action, then the glory of God can be seen in those who have no right or entitlement of their own making other than through the saving grace of Jesus, that is, his church. And I'd just like to say, you're already doing a great job. That's what I was experiencing last Sunday. So keep it up. And I am open to offers of lunch anytime you like. So as I close, you may wish to just close your eyes for a moment as we think about this. In one of the confessions in the Anglican liturgy, there is a line from Psalm 51. It reminds us of the hope of the gospel message. And just maybe we can make this our prayer today. It says, "Wash away our wrongdoing and restore us to the joy of your salvation. Amen."